reading paper.
Welcome to episode number 118 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. You can also find the show notes for this episode at HelenHebertStudio.com/podcast. Today, I'm talking with Julie McLaughlin, who has been making paper and exploring its sculptural possibilities since the early 1990s. She has been making large sheets from Kozo fibers for the last 14 years. Her interest in wearable paper garments subconsciously began over 50 years ago when she wore her first paper dress. Those were popular in the 1960s. And she continues to push the boundaries between paper and textiles today. Eastern fibers work well for this, as they are extremely strong, allowing her to make thin, fluid sheets which easily adapt to wearable art. These non-woven sheets are referred to as kami kogami. McLaughlin shows her sculptural work and wearable paper garments nationally and internationally, and her work is in numerous private and corporate collections. Well, Julie McLaughlin, welcome to Paper Talk.
Thank you for having me. It should be interesting.
Yeah. We were just chatting and laughing and goofing off. So, we'll see what happens. Okay. Tell me a little bit about where you grew up and any creative parts of your life and, how you got into your paper journey.
Okay. Well, I grew up on a farm and I was the youngest of three kids, but I think that really inspired me. You know, growing up on a farm, if there was something that needed to be done, you did it yourself and you figured out how to do it. So that was part. I mean, I showed horses. We raised cattle. My dad was also a grain farmer. So that was kind of the beginning of my career.
And where was this?
Oh, in Iowa.
Okay. So still in Iowa. Yeah.
I was going to graduate from high school and move as far away as possible and made it to Wichita, Kansas for a few months. And then I moved back to Iowa. So, you know.
Yeah.
When we were in the farm, my parents were heavily involved in 4-H. Mm-hmm. And so I was too. And that's where, I mean, I learned how to refinish furniture. My sister taught me how to sew. I taught my mother how to sew.
Oh.
She had a flower shop, so we did a lot of flower arranging. She had beautiful gardens, things like that. So I think 4-H was probably the first precursor to mm-hmm. creative things. Mm-hmm. But I'll have to say I joined art club in high school only because the art teacher was cute and we all had a crush on him.
Uh-huh.
And what's kind of funny is I was really intimidated by that white sheet of paper. I mean, I was scared to death of drawing anything that was flat. Sculptural work, you know, like ceramics, things like that. I was much more comfortable doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of grew from there. I know it was quite a while before I actually learned how to make paper. I started my undergrad right after high school. I was majored in a lot of things that you probably shouldn't be majoring in when you were 18 to 20. And so I left and went back to the farm and worked for my dad. We had a big stable for the horses and stuff. So I worked for him. And I also worked for my mother in the flower shop for quite a while. So, and then It was probably, I also, well, I learned how to sew. And so when I was showing horses, I made a lot of shirts for the guys and some of the Western shirts. And back in the day, you had your monogrammed initials, like on the cuff or on the pocket. So I did a lot of that, and I sold a lot of those. So that's kind of also, sewing has always been a part of my life.
Did you actually make the shirts? Or do,
yes.
In addition to putting the monograms and all that. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. I made everything from scratch. I took their measurements and, you know, went from there. So when Mike and I got married, we lived very close to a professional theater, the Old Creamery Theater. And so I became their costume designer. And I worked there for probably 8 or 10 years. I designed costumes for the shows. I also made them. And it was then that I realized that I needed to go back and finish what I had started in college. So I went back to school as a non-traditional student. Mm-hmm. I was probably in my early 30s by then.
I want to ask, what were you studying originally that you just didn't like?
I was a phys ed major.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And I realized pretty quickly that I did not want to teach. Uh-huh. And back, you know, that was in the early 70s. And so to be in phys ed, there were no gyms. You know, I couldn't, there wasn't really a personal trainer option.
Right.
So I realized that wasn't a venue I wanted. That wasn't a path I wanted to.
Right. Okay, so back to the early 30s. Where were you then? In Iowa somewhere? Or
in Iowa. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. And so Mike and I lived in a little town called Dysart, Iowa, about 1,200 people. We don't live there anymore, but so this theater was close. He was on the board. And so it's one of those things that you just kind of migrate and you get yourself involved and then you end up employed there. Uh-huh. So when I went back to school, I ended up in the printmaking department, and that's what my degree is in, is printmaking. But that's where I met Jo Siddons, who, she was my early introduction into papermaking. So, and I know you know Jo.
Yeah.
From Portland.
We were in Portland together, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what kind of got me started there. She went on sabbatical, and Richard Hungerford came in and taught for her.
Oh, and what school was this?
Oh, the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls.
Okay.
So he really opened my eyes to the overbeaten abaca and flax and stretching things around an armature, which I still do to this day.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
So anyway, yeah. And so that's what got me started.
Okay. So you were doing printmaking, but it sounds like there was papermaking. You could do that every semester or every so often, or?
Yeah, actually Jo taught, the papermaking studio was right in the print studio.
Okay.
And much to the chagrin of all of the printmakers who didn't want to make paper because, you know, it was kind of a mess. And so she incorporated papermaking into the printmaking, that, you know, the intro print classes. But I'll have to say, we made all of our paper from cotton. It was all on 8.5 by 11 inch molds. It was pretty standard paper making. And I wasn't all that interested in it because it was a big, long process, and printmaking is a big, long process. So I didn't feel I needed all those processes. That's what it's all about, process. But so it wasn't until Richard came in when he taught for her that I realized that there were other fibers and other ways you could use paper, especially in a three-dimensional way. And that's what I really liked. So.
Yeah. And listeners, if you haven't heard of Rick Hungerford, look him up. He, I think he's still in Singapore maybe, but he taught at the School of the Art Institute for a while. And yeah, he's a name in papermaking.
So, So yeah, it was quite an honor to be able to work with him. Actually, I learned a lot from him. So,
right. Cool. And you also, you had children at this time. Is that right? So you were,
yeah,
your
I
family.
Did.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. So, we had three boys. Two of them were Mike's from another marriage that I adopted. And then we had Ryan together. So we had three kids. So it was pretty busy lifestyle. Yeah. So I remember taking a workshop at Anderson Ranch in Colorado one year, and it was a printmaking workshop. And the instructor was asking me, you know, about my life and stuff. And she was appalled that I chose my family over my career. And she said that if her then partner had requested that, she would have left him. And I just thought, wow, okay. So I guess I chose my family and never went beyond an undergrad degree because I felt I needed to be with them rather than go after an MFA. So anyway.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I know. And she didn't have children. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
So I know this is a choice that many artists make. Or they deliberate about. And I never questioned. I always knew I would have children. Like, it wasn't even a question for me. I don't know about you. But I don't know. One thing that just popped into mind when you were sharing that is that maybe she thought you were a really good artist. Maybe it was a compliment in a backhanded way that she really thought your work was great and you should be choosing it instead of your family. I don't know. So
yeah,
anyways.
I never thought of it that way, but yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So I know I read somewhere that you wore a paper dress and that somehow, because your work, you make paper dresses and kimonos and things. And so tell me about that early. When was
I think I must have been in maybe sixth grade or seventh grade. And my mother was a quirky, lovable woman. And she found this paper dress. And I thought that was the coolest thing in the whole world. And it was just a real simple A-line sleeveless dress. Mm-hmm. And then I had a pair of Piet Mondrian styled go-go boots. So I would wear my go-go boots with my paper dress. And I think I wore it probably to a dance, you know, a school dance. I thought I was, you know, pretty cool. And nobody else shared that opinion. So I only wore it a couple times. Aww. I kept it for years. And I tried to find it when we, you know, my parents are both deceased now. And when I closed out the house and stuff, I looked, I thought, I can't believe I threw those boots away or that dress away, but, somebody did. But,
so was that in the '60s?
Probably, sixties. Yeah. So, so I think subconsciously that's what got me started, you know, that's what planted the seed. So, you know, and along with that, I never sewed on paper, but I did a lot of knitting and crocheting and sewing and stuff all through my younger years. So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That paper dress. I wish I had that. Might be worth a lot of money.
Yeah, there was, I got to see that exhibition in New York last year. I'm blanking on the name of it, but they had lots of paper dresses, and there were like kits that you could buy, like the mother and children dresses, and even like a tablecloth for a picnic. And oh
Yes,
my gosh,
you could have
way more
matching
than I knew.
napkins and tablecloths. Yes.
What a,
That's pretty crazy.
and there were artists who designed, special dresses for different companies. Yeah. Very interesting backstory about the paper dresses. Okay, anyways, so after you studied printmaking and discovered paper making, what happened next?
I was still working in the theater, and I designed the costumes for Theater UNI, the theater at the University of Northern Iowa, for the show called Equus, which, if you're familiar with that, it's kind of a modern day. The costumes aren't anything special, and there's actually a lot of nudity on stage anyway. So, but there's six actors who play the horses in this disturbed young man's mind. And so that's when Richard was also there. And so
Okay.
we made the masks that the actors wore out of welded steel rod and overbeaten abaca. And I styled them after the skull of a horse. So all of the suture, bone suture joints, that was a rod. And so it really did look like a skull when these guys put these masks on. And then the lighting designer backlit them. And so they glowed whatever color related to the mood that this young man was in. So it was really cool. And that's what the actors, by the way, hated them, but it was really cool from the audience standpoint. But that's what made me realize that I really liked pairing the paper with the steel rod. Because most people view paper as being very fragile and weak, but steel rod, that's not going to bend, that's not going to change, and it's the total opposite. So, and at that time, I was also making a lot of corsets for the stage, and so that's what I thought. Oh, you know what? Corsets shouldn't be on our bodies, but they're really beautiful. And the silhouette. And so that's what got me into the welded steel rod armatures based on the corset. And then I would cover it with the overbeaten flax and abaca papers.
Okay, and were you working in the facilities at the university, like for the welding and the paper making?
Yeah, one of the sculpture professors taught me how to weld. And then I knew that I wasn't going to have access to the university forever. And so I went out and I bought my own welder and started welding in our garage. And then when I moved my studio to downtown Dysart, I had a perfect place out back that I could weld there. So. So I did all my own welding after that.
And then what about the paper making?
And then the paper making, yeah, I bought my Raina beater. Gosh, I think it was probably 24 years ago. So, because I, the university had a small valley beater, but as long as there was paper making there, I didn't really have access to it. So I splurged and bought my own Raina. And my dad bought a big drill press out of a farm catalog, and he made a paper press for me. So that I still have that. It can do a 22 by 30 inch sheet of paper press, a post of paper. So going back to those farm days, I wanted it and we built it. So, yeah.
And by the way, listeners, I have a short video that I'm going to post on YouTube, and you'll find the link in the show notes for this. I visited Julie, oh my gosh, probably 2016, and took this video, intended to record a podcast, and whatever, life happened. Here we are. But you can see some of her equipment in this video. Yeah, we did a little, and this is in her current studio.
Yes.
Yeah, and I know you're, I'm thinking of some of your corset pieces, and they are colorful or richly saturated. So talk a little bit about the papers you were making for those.
I would really overbeat the abaca and the flax. And in the old valley beater that was at the university, you could do that, you know, in 2 or 3 hours, because you could really crank that down and put a lot of weight on it. The Reina beater, it took me a learning period on that, because it was totally different. And so now it's more like, you know, 4 to 6, 7 hours that I was beating the paper. Sometimes I would overbeat it and it would be, it would be brittle, especially the abaca. So, you know, you have to learn the hard way on a lot of that.
Did you beat them separately?
Yes.
And
yes,
the flax
I did.
Was raw flax?
It was that type R flax that you can
R
get at
Carriage
Carriage
House.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you cook it? I'm sorry, I have so many questions. No.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't. I started cooking it, and then I talked to, I don't know, it might have been like Melissa J. Craig or somebody who was, why are you cooking this? You know, it's not, you're not making archival paper, you know, flat sheets of production paper. And so, no, I quit cooking it, and I just, I soaked it. I soaked everything overnight and then threw it in. And I also have found that, you know, I have a 2 pound beater, but I'll only put a pound of fiber in, dry fiber in, and fill the rest with water, because I think that really pushes the water into the fiber. And so it shrinks more, you know, as it dries. So that's just my theory. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. But I've always beaten just 1 pound of fiber in my 2 pound beater. But then I've noticed that the more you beat your fibers, when you pigment it, it dries darker. And I really like that. And so that's how I get a lot of the richness in the colors. Where, you know, cotton, I would always be so disappointed, because you'd have this really great red when the paper was wet, and then it would dry to pink. And where the, with the overbeaten fibers, it's just the opposite. And I really like that.
Yeah. Well, abaca for sure is more translucent by nature. So the color, and then beating it longer, you're saying it really, it gets darker.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
And, why are you mixing the abaca and the cotton? And is it 50-50 or?
Yeah, it's about 50-50. And it's not abaca and cotton, abaca and flax. Yeah. I originally, when I was covering these corsets, I was just using the abaca, because I really liked that translucency. But I found after a year or two, when these would absorb humidity and then dry out, you know, just hanging around in my studio, that the paper started cracking. And so I incorporated the flax as to add more strength, maybe a little bit more flexibility, where it would still, you know, shrink and do its thing. It was maybe a little stronger. The paper was stronger, because I make these sheets pretty thin also.
Okay. So yeah, I wanted to get to that. So you're making the sheets, what size are you working? And then you're wrapping them onto these armatures.
I started building a lot of my own molds and decals, and using the, deckel box type thing, you know, I feel so I could get away with making you know, my own molds and just using window screen because it had a layer of interfacing on top of it. So you didn't get that screen imprint on your paper. So I started making all kinds of sizes. I started with 9x12 because I didn't like that 8.5x11. And then 16x20. I've made molds up to 4 foot by 6 foot on my own, you know, and then usually takes two people to pull that plastic out when they're that big. But so it's sort of like, you know, when you start a project, it's kind of like, oh, what new tool can I go buy? So I would design something, figure out what size paper would be good to cover that because I didn't want to piece it. And so then I would make a mold to fit that, whatever size I needed.
Got it. And just talk real quick about your system for like attaching a sheet to your welded steel armature.
Okay. So on the corsets, I would make the corset and then I would actually pattern the corset like I was sewing it. So I would have pattern pieces. And so I'd pull my sheet of paper. I would lay these newsprint pattern pieces on top of the wet paper.
After it was pressed?
Yeah, lightly pressed. In fact, I would press it just so I could work with it. You know, I'd take just enough water out that it wasn't totally fragile, but I still wanted it pretty wet. So I would lay these pattern pieces down. I wouldn't take scissors or anything to cut it. So I would just, my finger width was my seam allowance.
Allowance.
And so I would just rip the paper, you know, using my finger. And then I would glue the pieces together. So I would have this wet mangle of paper sort of in the shape of the corset, and then I would glue it on the top and glue it on the bottom to the rod and then let it dry. So I quickly found out that you have to make the wet paper sheets much bigger than the actual armature because they shrink so much that, you know, there's a fine line between shrinking and ripping, you know, just falling apart, and shrinking and forming, you know, perfectly with the armature. So I liked it taut like a drum, you know, I wanted it hard. So
And we'll post a picture of one of these.
Okay.
And so would they rip apart at the seams or other places?
No. Well, sometimes they did, but most, if I did a good job gluing and then removing a lot of the moisture on that seam, you know, I would go through with a paper towel and really suck up as much moisture as I could on that seam. The glue, and I just used PVA glue, it really held. And then I would put that on the top rod and the bottom rod. The thing that I really like about this is I think it's I'm collaborating with the paper because I got to the point where I had to cover it about 5 o'clock in the afternoon and then go away because if I would stand there and watch it dry, I was constantly manipulating or tinkering and you know, I learned you just go away and let the paper do its thing. A lot of the times the paper would rearrange my steel rod. It was stronger than the rod. So I would come back to a totally different shape or a different shape than what I had intended. So
what was the thickness of the rod?
Eighth inch steel rod.
Because I made a piece that was 1/4 inch and I was surprised that it moved a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I had to connect two pieces And I couldn't connect them after they were covered with paper in the way that I had intended. I figured out a different way because I wasn't going to start over.
Yeah,
But yeah,
it's
paper's
kind of
strong.
crazy how,
Yeah.
you know, and, you know, of course, at the waistline, as the paper would dry, it would really, because these would be, it would be like a 16 or 18 inch expand, you know, that's how long the rods were. So that's a lot of distance.
Right.
So that paper would shrink and the rods would rebend and really, you know, what I thought was going to be like a 8 inch waist suddenly was a 4 inch waist because it shrunk everything down so much. So,
right. Wow. Wow. Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to tell you about The Paper Year, my online membership club, which is now open for registration. This is an annual subscription club, kind of like a year-long online class, featuring a new paper project every month. Get inspired with video tutorials and written project instructions designed to spark ideas that keep you creating all month long. Explore creative paper techniques, including origami, pop-ups, paper weaving, book arts, paper cutting, and more. And join our growing community of paper lovers online to learn and share in a warm, encouraging, supportive, creative community. Visit HelenHebertStudio.com to find out more and hold your spot or sign up. Registration is open December 20th through January 9th, 2023. The first project of 2024 will be delivered on January 2nd. And as soon as you sign up, you'll have access to the library of all of our past projects. Now back to our conversation. I know that you moved to making kimonos and using Kozo and Eastern fibers. How did that transition happen?
Yeah, I was trying to remember how that all came about. And I think I had a big gallery exhibition at UNI, but it was based on a play, The House of Bernarda Alba. And I worked with a lighting designer and a dramaturg. And so the three of us collaborated on this show. And it was a play without actors. So I welded the steel rod figures. And this story, it's set in Spain, I believe. And it's about a mother and her daughters. And it starts with a funeral. We picked five scenes from the play.
Okay.
And so, and then you had to walk through the exhibition in a specific way. It started with the funeral. So it was perfect because we had the little funeral cards, you know, here lies and daughter of, and blah. So we kind of introduced everybody to the characters. But anyway, I decided that I wanted to use Kozo as the main fiber because it was a little more flexible for these garments. Cause I mean, I made huge skirts and, you know, things like that. So, I worked and I don't know how I got in touch, but I ended up at UICB, the Center for the Book here at the University of Iowa. And Tim helped me beat the Kozo fiber and Lynn Amley was here.
So
at that time,
Tim Barrett, yeah, and
Tim
Lynn,
Barrett
Lynn Amley.
And Lynn Amley, and she was fabulous. I mean, she really helped me through a lot of, you know, how to, because I think I bet we went through 40 or 50 pounds of Kozo. I mean, that's how, because I had to repeat these costumes five different times.
Gosh. And you were hand beating the Kozo? Or...
Well, yes, but then we went down and used the Naginata beater that
okay,
is at the,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I would hand beat for a while and then we would throw it in the Naginata. And actually I used their stamper beater. They had a stamper beater
okay.
there too.
Okay.
So that really helped the whole process.
Yeah.
And then Lynn helped me with, dyeing the fiber black because, you know, everybody was in mourning. So I had to have a lot of black going on. And so she was a big influence on that show.
How did you use dye? What was the...
Well, I used pigment.
Okay.
And it was, I really, oh my God, it was a disaster. And she told me, she said, don't use pigment, use dye for this project. And yeah, I knew more than she did. Well, no, I didn't. So, but it all worked out fine. And so it was a combination of the Kozo, and then for the bodices, I used the flax and abaca, like I had always done. But so I think that's what sort of got me into realizing what a fabulous fiber Kozo is, and how it was more textile. And so it kind of led me back to the original of, you know, I got back into sewing with paper, things like that. Cause this Kozo is really, it's very fabric cloth like. So,
you stitched some of those costumes.
Yes. Yes. Uh-huh. The skirts I stitched, using a sewing machine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of when I realized that, oh, okay, let's go back to that paper dress from the 60s and see what happens.
Right.
And then I don't know where I ran across this, but there is a master dyer. He is now deceased in Japan. His name is Ichiku Kubota. And he has this whole series of kimonos that are landscapes. I think he has his own gallery in Japan, near Mount Fuji.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that, I mean, I ran across one of these books and I was just mesmerized by his work and the kimono itself. And in some of the reading, I was realized that a lot of Japanese artists use the kimono as their canvas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was a garment, a wearable garment, but it was a way for them to showcase their work. So, I mean, the kimono is a very simple structure. Mm-hmm. And so I think I love working with the kimono and just the history and the tradition and the fact that, here I can work with my paper, turn it into a three-dimensional object, and yeah.
Right. So I'm curious about the pattern of the kimono. Is it one sheet, two, three? And I know we can go into a combination of, you've taught big-ass paper making. I know you make big paper, and I'm guessing it was for these kimonos. That's how it started. Okay.
Yes. So this is going to be a long story. Sorry. I guess I'll go way back to, even though I didn't get my MFA, I joined IAPMA early on, and I joined Dart Hunter, which is now North American Hand Paper Makers. So,
IAPMA is the International Paper Group, and North American Hand Paper Makers is the American group.
Yeah.
And they,
yes.
Yeah. They're organizations.
Mm-hmm. And so I went to a lot of those conferences. I took as many workshops as I could through them, or just, you know, area workshops or regional workshops. So I ended up taking a workshop from a student of Joan Hall's, and she taught large sheet formation. And I immediately came back and thought, this is what I want, because it was thin, beautiful, flexible Kozo sheets. I designed all my own screens, and I went 6 foot by 9 foot, because 6 foot, 72 inches wide, you know, 9 foot long, that's 3 yards. It's like yardage for a garment. So, so that's how I came upon, or how I decided on that size. And then I went down from that, because that's pretty big. So I made my own vat. I made 10 or 12 of these screens because the paper dries right on the screen. When we lived in Dysart, we had a pickleball court in our backyard. And so it was also a perfect paper making, big ass paper making, because I could set the vat up and I had room for all of the screens so the paper could dry right there.
So what do you mean by the vat? Because aren't you doing the plastic thing still or no? Describe
no.
your technique of making these sheets.
So the vat is, it's 8 foot by 10 foot.
Okay.
And it's lined. Now I line it with a pond liner. Before I would line it with the, those blue tarps, uh-huh. you know, that you can buy. And so you make your own vat. The screens, it takes at least four people, more 6 or 8 people is much better. And so you take you have these screens. You literally
a screen with a frame.
Yes.
And a decal, like a mold and a decal, or just the mold?
No, just the screen.
Okay.
And it's stretched between, I actually use 1-inch aluminum tubing for the outside.
Okay.
And I've stretched, and I use mosquito netting and no-see-um netting for the screen.
Okay.
So these are unsupported. So you have to be really careful when it comes up out of the water. Otherwise, all of your fiber is going to go to the center. And mm-hmm. so you have to be very patient as it comes out, you know, follow your water line and slowly raise it out. But anyway, in this vat, two people have to get in the vat and you grab the screen and you drag it along the bottom. And then the screen lays on the bottom of your vat that has your water and your fiber and your formation aid. And you walk right on top of the screen. You distribute the pulp. It's really kind of fun. It's like Lucy stomping grapes.
So and this 1 inch, I'm just trying to picture this. The 1 inch is underneath. So you're just
yes.
careful that you, that's not very, so you're pressing down the screen. Yeah.
Right. And yeah. But then the screen floats. So as soon as you get off it,
yeah,
it'll come to the top.
Okay.
And then you slowly lift it out, you know, one person on each side and slowly lift it out. I strive for a really thin sheet. So way back in the day, I mean, there were four of us that used to do this. Mm-hmm. I have since moved everything to the Morgan in Cleveland.
Okay.
And we started making the sheets a little bit heavier. So suddenly we needed 8 or 10 people around this screen to get it out of the water. And so it's changed a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And the paper is much nicer now, of course. But yeah. So the big ass paper making is, I laugh because I taught this class to students at UNI after I had graduated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they coined that phrase because okay. they were watching me bend over in the vat. And so, but that's my story. So anyway, so yes, that's the big ass vat.
Right. And so did one of those sheets become a kimono or what's kind of the.
Yes. In fact, sometimes it would be 3 or 4 of those sheets would be become a kimono. I make them, you know, 5 inches in height to okay. 7 foot in height. Right. So, the ones that are huge, they usually take about 5 sheets of the, at least 5x8 or 6x9 paper. And then before I use this sewing machine, I stitch them, I treat it just like fabric, mm-hmm. but I'll do all of my dyeing, any surface manipulation, I do that before I make it into the kimono shape. So,
right. But now you're taking naturally colored kozo and doing different treatments after
yes.
the paper's dry.
Yes.
And
Yes.
just talk a little bit about some of those. I mean, these kimonos are gorgeous, listeners, and we'll put a couple of images, in the show notes.
So yeah, I was teaching this class out in Cleveland at the Morgan, and one of my students was a fiber artist, and she did a lot of indigo dyeing. Rebecca Cross is her name.
Okay.
And so it was in that class that she taught me and my students how to shibori dye and different wrapping techniques and things like that. And she started an indigo vat. This was a 3 or 4 day workshop, so we had plenty of time to do this. And so that's kind of what got me into the indigo end of dyeing the paper. And then there's also a technique called jumchi, which is like paper felting. It's a Korean. So I quickly realized that if I would spray a fiber reactive dye onto the Kozo sheet of paper and not treat it so that it was not permanent, and then so, and these are, I would spray dye the really thin, practically not usable sheets of paper I had. And then I would rip that into little pieces, different shapes and stuff. I totally wet the paper that is the main body of the kimono. And then I would lay these fiber reactive dyed sheets on top and wet it all down again. And using that jumchi process, which is totally saturating the paper and then wadding it up and squeezing and doing all that. And so I would do that, lay it back out. And because I hadn't made those fiber reactive dyes color fast, they kind of bled one into the other. And it turned into these beautiful watercolor like imagery. So I use that a lot. Instead of wadding it into a ball like traditional, jumchi is, I would have to pleat it because these are big sheets of paper. And so I would lay it down and I would hand pleat it and then I'd wring it, and do stuff like that. So it's hard on your hands. But so then roll that out. Let the paper dry and then cut my pieces and finish the kimono.
Stitch
So,
away. And you exhibit these. Talk a little bit about that, 'cause I love how they look exhibited.
I use a, I t I'm assuming you're talking about the rod that I hang them on, and which is a pretty traditional way of, displaying a kimono. So I have translucent rods, or I have dowels that I use. And sometimes if I'm going to hang the kimono so that it's the back is exposed, and then you fold out the front, so it's hard to
Dimensional.
describe. And so then I would have a hook that would hold the dowel right where the neckline is, the collar. So the collar is up on top and it would hide the hook. And so it would look like this kimono is just sort of floating on the wall because you really can't see how it's attached. And this dowel is an inch away from the wall or 2 inches away from the wall. So it's like it's just floating there.
Yeah, and then
Otherwise,
the sleeves are, because the sleeves hang down, so you really see the full kimono because you have this straight rod going through the two sleeves.
And then other ways of doing it is, the rod and then having the two hooks on each end, so you would see the hooks. Or sometimes I will run monofilament through it, you know, put two little screw eyes, run monofilament through and hang it from the ceiling or something like that.
Right.
So the really big ones, you know, that are 7 foot in height, they're, they look really neat when they're suspended from a ceiling, you know, so that they're just hanging there and you have to walk around them.
Yeah. They have a real presence. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yep. So,
tell me a little bit about, exhibiting and selling your work.
I participate in some shows now. I think my last solo show was a couple years ago. And I have a gallery in Manchester, England, Richard Newall Gallery, that sells a lot of my work. He used to have a storefront, but since the pandemic, he now just goes to art fairs and things like that. And then I've had a couple galleries in the Cleveland area that have sold some of my work, but I'll have to say I'm terrible about promoting myself and, you know, getting out there and pushing. But I do have, you know, I do probably, well, several commissions every year, things like that. So I still keep.
How do you get those?
Well, like this year, I donated a piece for an auction at the Morgan Conservatory for their big fundraiser they held in July. And it was a live auction, and there was kind of a bidding war on this kimono. Okay. And the man who lost the bid came up to me afterwards and asked if he could commission me to do a piece. So it's kind of word of mouth, things like that.
So. And what about the gallery in England? Like, how did you connect with them?
I had a gallery here in Iowa that was selling my work, and I don't even know how he ended up in Iowa from Manchester, England, but he was in that gallery. And so he saw my work, and when he went back home, he contacted me to see if I would be interested in sending work over there, which I did. And then it was probably 6 or 8 years before he contacted me again. So, you know, it was one of those deals where, he bought a lot of stuff. Yeah. So anyway, it's been a great relationship so far.
Cool.
We'll see.
All right. And you've mentioned the Morgan a couple of times. I know you're very involved there. So just tell me a little bit about your involvement and
I think so I ended up purchasing that Valley Beater from UNI when they closed down their paper studio, but I didn't need it. So I called Tim Barrett to see if he knew of anybody. And he said, oh yeah, there's this guy in Cleveland, Tom Balbo, that he's starting this big art center, and I think he might be interested. So I contacted Tom, and he bought it right away, and he came to pick it up. And we just happened to be invited to a wedding that same year in Cleveland. And so we were out there, and of course he invited us. And this was before the Morgan was the Morgan. I mean, he took us on a tour of this building, and I told him he was nuts.
This is a huge warehouse space. So I could imagine.
But boy, he had a vision, and he saw it through. And it is, I love the Morgan. It is, I mean, there's a huge paper making studio, letterpress studio, a bindery, and a lot of usable space. There's a parking lot out back where that's the Kozo Garden is connected to, which is perfect for my big ass paper making classes. And they do workshops there. There's a gallery there for exhibitions. It's just a really fun place that everyone is welcome to come. So it's a great place to work. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been talking to people recently who have contacted me and are really having a hard time figuring out where to learn how to make paper. And I think the Morgan is probably the most accessible place.
Yeah.
And people are willing to travel for the most part. So yeah, it's just, it's tricky to find facilities. And the Morgan has a residency where people
yes.
can do their work, and then classes and workshops. That's not to say there aren't other places, but it just, it is one of the main places.
It is one of the main ones. The thing that attracted me to it is, in a lot of areas, if you're not attached to a university, then it's really difficult to find the necessary equipment that you need to, after you graduate, you know, a lot of people can't afford a letter press or even a beater or anything like that. So you can rent studio space there and come in, and you have access to everything. And they do have a Naginata beater, as well as quite a few other beaters. But it's a great place. I highly recommend it.
Yeah. Well, and I just want to say this about the Naginata beater, since you've mentioned it twice. So it's a little different than a Hollander beater. It's for teasing Japanese fibers apart, so it doesn't grind or beat them like a Hollander does. And there are only three in the U.S. I learned. I was at the North American Hand Papermakers meeting in Providence, Rhode Island, where one is, which I got to see recently. And then Tim Barrett was there. Tim, by the way, has been on this podcast, as has Tom Balbo. So listeners, if you want to go back and listen to those. So the University of Iowa has one, and the Morgan.
And yeah.
Those are the three. And David Reyna built two of them, I believe. And the one in Iowa maybe was built in Iowa.
I think Cambridge. It was, because it has a fiberglass body where the other two Reynas are the stainless steel, like they're a David Reyna design Naginata. But I didn't realize that RISD has one.
Yeah,
I didn't.
They do.
Yeah.
I don't really know why, but they do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
I mean, they have a nice papermaking studio there. Wow. Well, you have access to some sweet facilities between Iowa and Cleveland. Yeah, that's nice.
I call myself a groupie at the Center for the Book here, because, you know, I'm not on staff, but I do go in and I'll demo once in a while. Mm-hmm. And Nicholas Claudis is bringing his class here in a couple weeks to tour the studio and stuff like that. So, I'm just a groupie there. I like to hang out.
Nick Claudis is there now. Tim Barrett retired, and Nick's been on the podcast too. What are you working on now?
Well, I am, I discovered spinning and weaving. And so I don't make as much paper as I used to anymore, but because I have stacks of paper. And so I am spinning a lot of it and using a traditional spinning wheel or a drop spindle. And then I am slowly getting into the weaving. My sister was a huge spinner and weaver, and I thought that was really dumb, you know, 40 years ago. But now I'm channeling her and getting back into it again. And then, so next spring in March, I am team teaching a spinning and weaving workshop at the Morgan, where we'll be making the Kami Ito. And then she weaves in a really non-traditional way. So, like, she uses orange skins. Paula Dam is the person I'm teaching with, but any armature will do. And then she'll make these gorgeous weavings As I said, she uses orange skins. She uses seed pods. She uses all kinds of stuff that she'll use as
a loom. So you're not weaving on a loom. You're
Well, I am,
you are,
sort of.
Okay.
Yeah, but she's not. But she's a pretty established fiber artist. You know, she is a weaver. She has a huge loom and stuff. But we laugh because I'm a little more traditional and she's not. So we pair with one another really well. So the students get both sides.
Oh, that sounds like a great workshop. And this podcast will come out way before that. So listeners, if you're interested, look it up.
Oh, okay.
And are you cutting the your paper like shifu to make Tama Ichi?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So it's really fun. And I was always using a drop spindle. I took a class from Velma Boyard and at the paper book intensive PBI. Mm-hmm. And it was so funny. I told her I hated it. And then when you're in a class like that and you're distracted and stuff.
Right.
So I came home and really worked on it. And then I found a spinning wheel, and I cannot spin wool or flax or cotton, but I can spin paper, by God. So it's a totally different technique, but makes it go much faster. And you can knit with it, crochet with it, weave with it, sew with it. So,
Wow. Well, I'm working on a book about paper weaving. We'll have to talk
off the
record about this, but very different. I'm going to mention shifu and, that's not the focus of the book. Well, gosh, this has been a delight. I want to get to your recommendations. So you had several books, and this is coming right at the right time. So Kigami and Kami Ito by Hiroko Karuno.
Yes.
So just tell me a little bit about that book.
It's written in Japanese, but the other side of the page has English translation for it. But it is the best source I have found for spinning the paper. I mean, it goes into what weight paper you should start with, how to fold it, how to cut it, how to roll it, all of the steps. And there's great pictures. I highly recommend it. And I think you can still get it at Washi Arts.
Yes, I looked it up and found it there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's, what's Kigami? What is that?
Kigami is the paper.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just the paper.
Paper and thread is maybe the translation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have to get that because I'm doing a paper and thread workshop. Again, but certainly
that would
be a nice resource. Yep. And then you mentioned A Song of Praise for Shifu by Susan Bird. And I included instructions from her on how to make shifu in my recent book, The Art of Papercraft.
Uh-huh.
So that's
she is dynamite, and she has two really good YouTube videos out that show the spinning of paper.
Cool.
So it is, she's great.
Okay. And I love you wrote to me that you treat your papers as textile, and I love that. And so you refer to textile surface design books a lot. And
Cool. And one of my favorites is this, The Art of Manipulating Fabric. I think I sent that to you.
Oh no, but I have that book.
Yeah.
I think there are two that are similar. I have both of them.
Oh, okay.
The different ways to fold them and stitch them and
pleat
and
yes.
I'll put that in the notes. Yeah. Wonderful.
And all of that, it's so easily adapted to paper.
Mm-hmm,
And then, but are you familiar with the work of Isabelle de Bourgeois? I'm sure I'm killing her.
She shows her paper garments all over the place.
I saw her show when we were in Italy, and oh my gosh, I was just floored by what this woman can do with a sheet of paper and how she creates all these fabulous period garments and shoes and wallpaper. And it was totally amazing. So
that's cool. I haven't seen him in person. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, and I know there's a lot of exhibition catalogs out there on her work, but.
Oh, wow. Okay. And where can we find you online, Julie?
I do have a website, mcjuliestudios.com. I can tell you right now, I am terrible at keeping it updated. So, I didn't really die in 2017 or 18 or 19, which
but there's good representation on there of your work. And it's Mick Julie Studios, mcjuliestudios.com.
Yes. Yes. And then I'm also on Instagram, at McJulie Studios, although once again, I'm terrible about posting things, but every now and then I will. So.
Okay.
There you go.
Great. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show, Julie. This was a real treat.
Sure. I'm glad we finally got to get together and do it. And we didn't even talk about the Hanji bat, so we'll have to do that again sometime.
Yes, that's right. Okay. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon.